Welcome to the Pinwheel Education Series. This is a recording of a past event. For more information, visit www.keltimentalhealth.ca or call us at 1-800-665-1822.
Today, discussing the benefits of mindfulness for youth, and our next series on the topic of obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD, is on September 29, 2011. I know that people find out about your sessions in a variety of ways, but you can always go onto our website, keltimentalhealth.ca, click on events to find out about the latest teleconference, and also we have a monthly email service. So if you want to be added onto that list, again, send me up through the website, or just from here, I'll be happy to do that. And I also want to mention that this teleconference today is recorded. I'm going to be putting it on the website so you can access it there. And I'm going to also be putting some resources on mindfulness on the website as well. So without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and introduce today's speaker. And on our panel, I have Dr. Jake Locke, and Jake is an associate clinical professor at BC Children's Hospital and UBC. He's worked at BC Children's Hospital as an adolescent and child psychiatrist for over 20 years. He's currently working in mood and anxiety clinic here at BC Children's Hospital, as well as urgent assessment. And mindfulness has been an important component of clinical work with children, adolescents, and adults for the past 3 years. I also have Dr. Zung Guo, and Zung is a pediatrician and adolescent medicine specialist at BC Children's Hospital. He cares for adolescents with chronic health conditions and stress, and his areas of interest include the interactions between stress and health and stress management and mindfulness in adolescents. And last but not least, Nikki is here. Nikki is our youth speaker and an 18-year-old student from North Vancouver who started seeing Dr. Guo in October of last year in order to treat her chronic pain condition. So I want to turn it over to Jake and myself.
Well, welcome everyone. I'm really excited to be part of this. We're going to do something a little bit unusual today, and we're going to actually start with a mindfulness practice. And the reason for this is because if you just talk about mindfulness without experiencing it, it's like eating a restaurant menu without tasting any of the food. So today we're going to start with tasting. Okay. And I'd like to invite everyone to find a comfortable seating position. Upright. Relax. You can place your hands on your lap. And if you feel comfortable doing so, you may choose to close your eyes. If you prefer to keep your eyes open, you may choose to put them facing downward with a soft, unfocused gaze. We're going to start by listening to a bell called the Bell of Mindfulness. This sound is a reminder for bringing full attention to the present moment. Please bring your full awareness to the present moment. Nowhere else to go, there's nothing else to do, but to be fully here right now, today, or all the things you did earlier today. If you can make your breathing any faster or slower or different, just bring your awareness to your breathing. If you can follow your in-breath from the very beginning of your in-breath to the middle, you can notice the pause between your in-breath and your out-breath. If you can follow your out-breath from the very beginning all the way through. Maybe you'll follow your breath from your nose through your chest rise, or your abdomen, rising and falling. So just your in-breath.
I'm doing it.
You bring your attention to your breathing. Breathing in, and those that are breathing.
Yeah.
Out, and those that are breathing out. In.
Yeah.
Out.
As you see.
Yeah.
As you see.
Inhaling, down, out. One sound of the bell to end this first mindfulness session. Please allow the bell.
Thank you for the exercise. I think I'm going to go and meet everybody on the list.
So, congratulations and thank you everyone for practicing. We just practiced together a very brief practice, which is called mindfulness in the West, and this is one of the most ancient practices. So I'd like to begin the talk just by describing, giving a brief definition and some historical background of mindfulness. The most common definition that I use was written by John Kabat-Zinn, and he defines mindfulness as, quote, paying attention in a particular way, on purpose, in the present moment, and non-judgmentally. So again, paying attention in a particular way, on purpose, in the present, and non-judgmentally. And there are a few qualities that we associate with mindfulness, including what's in the definition of non-judgment, because sometimes judgment is a barrier to being fully aware of what's happening in the present moment. Also, something called loving-kindness, or sometimes translated as heartfulness or compassion, having goodwill and respect for whatever is happening in and around us. And the background, and mindfulness is a practice, so it's something that we can cultivate in every moment of our lives with formal and informal practices. So it's sounds very simple, but it's actually a training that we can do to get stronger at. And historically, this came from John Kabat-Zinn's work at the University of Massachusetts. And he was at the medical center there, but he was also practicing meditation at a nearby meditation center. And historically, this comes from very ancient meditation practices. And he realized that there were a lot of patients at his medical center who were suffering from chronic stress, chronic pain, and chronic illness. And he thought that mindfulness might be a way to help them. So he created a program called Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction at the Stress Reduction Clinic at UMass. And this was an 8-week group-based course for adults, which helps adults learn mindfulness practices to cope with their stress and pain and illness. And that was the beginning of it. And since then, there are hundreds of mindfulness-based stress reduction classes, as well as many other forms of mindfulness in clinical practice. But this was really kind of the foundation of using mindfulness in a clinical application in a secular manner.
So Zun and I have just recently returned from the first international conference on mindfulness in youth, and a few of our colleagues, Susan and Tamara, were also present. And the main speaker there was Daniel Siegel, who's a very well-known child psychiatrist and researcher, and he gave us quite a nice overview of some of the research in mindfulness to date. And he referenced the work of John Kabat-Zinn and Richie Davidson out of Harvard, and one of the things that they knew already was that functional MRI scans, people who are more happy tend to have more left prefrontal lobe activity in their on their MRI scans. So they basically did the research, including asking the Dalai Lama's monks to come over and be tested, and found that when they took a cohort of people and baseline scanned them, and then subjected them to mindfulness meditation, they had this thing called the left shift, which basically the left prefrontal lobes were brighter on subsequent scans. And the people all claimed to be happier and more content, more resilient, and manage stress a lot better. So the research has mainly been done with adults, but it's been extrapolated to children and youth. And what they also found was immune function for meditators was significantly improved. So, for instance, if you had a cold, your cold would go away 20% faster than if you were to meditate. Other research showed that particle thickness and regional gray matter increased. That's a good thing, because we generally lose that stuff as time goes on. There was research done by Jeffrey Schwartz at UCLA a few years back with patients with OCD and depression, and he basically used the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy approach and found that the meditators and had an equal result as Zoloft, which is a common medication used for OCD. One of the really cool things that came out of that's coming out of the research is an increase in telomerase. So essentially, that means if you meditate, your telomeres will stay longer in length for a longer period of time. Your cell life will last longer. You will live longer. So that research is just going to be out now. So that's good for us, but it could also be good for kids. The clinical research done by psychologists mainly shows increased awareness in kids, increased resilience, and interestingly, increased empathy and compassion. So that's a pretty cool finding. The benefits? Basically, people learn how to take better care of themselves. There's an increased awareness of the way things really are, not the way you necessarily want them to be. And that awareness just comes into all parts of our life, especially when most of us are on what's called automatic pilot. Can go through life one step after another without actually thinking about it and being aware. But the other really cool part about mindfulness is its improvement in self-regulation, something we all need. The kids really need to learn to self-regulate. And so you can sort of see how self-regulation would tie into ADHD and attention control, into disruptive behaviors and aggressive behaviors. So if kids can learn to self-regulate, those things come under significant improvement. A lot of the work that Zim and I have been sort of looking at has already been done, and we're going to be repeating some of it. And one of them is anxiety management and stress management, and that obviously is affecting our youth in a big way these days. And the other piece that we'll be looking at is a thing called mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which we'll look at dealing with depression in youth, and it's already been well studied in adults. So in terms of clinical uses, lots of stuff out there. The schools, even in Vancouver, I think Vancouver has some of the best mindfulness programs in the world. There's a program called Mind Up, and we're meeting with the founder of that tomorrow morning. And there's another program called SMART. And so they're not actually dealing directly with mental health issues, but they're actually helping both teachers and students get more resilient and self-regulated. Teachers need it too. The clinical use is already out there. Dialectical behavior therapy, many of you may be already aware of. It was designed by Marshall Monaghan and was to address borderline personality disorder, and she was able to be one of the few people that got coverage by the medical services in the United States because it worked, and mindfulness was a really important component of that. Then we'll talk about MBSR a bit more. MBCT, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, recently has been addressing children, or using children, with this book that I'll talk about in a little bit. But it was basically developed with Jan Kadison in conjunction with Williams, Zindel Siegel, and I can't remember the other. Okay. Those are the two names. Mindfulness-based relapse prevention is, again, another mindfulness-based intervention that we're using for concurrent disorders. So individuals with drug abuse and concurrent psychiatric disorder. Lots of other clinical uses we can talk about. I know Susan and Kamara are using it at Flat Place, and there's a fair bit of research in the States where it's being used for cancer patients.
So at this time, we'd like to shift gears a little bit and specifically focus on mindfulness-based interventions with youth, because that's why we're all here. We're at a children's hospital, and we really care about our young people and want to promote the health of our young people. And one of the most exciting interventions with youth, and I really feel that this whole area of mindfulness with youth is really on the cusp of exploding. There's a tremendous amount of interest, a lot of new research coming out. You'll see it a lot in the lay press in the past year or so as well. So I think we're really at a historical moment. One major area is in school-based settings, and this goes from elementary school all the way to secondary school and even into university. And the idea is that even with non-clinical samples, with young people, mindfulness can be an important tool to promote resilience, to promote healthy coping, and hopefully help people to live to their full potential and reduce mental health and medical problems later. And the research on that is very promising. Another area that this is being used is in juvenile justice settings. With, as most of you know, many people in juvenile justice settings have mental health issues, have emotional regulation challenges, and some of the emerging research of mindfulness in juvenile justice settings is also very promising in terms of helping the young people manage their moods, regulate their emotions, and reduce violence and recidivism. Another area that is being looked at is in obesity, and we all know that obesity is one of the major public health challenges facing children and youth today. And there's an intervention called mindful eating, which is starting to be explored using mindfulness in terms of how we eat and our dietary habits to promote healthier eating and reduce obesity. And then another another very interesting one for parents in the room is called Mindfulness-Based Childbirth and Parenting. And this came out of a group at the University of California, San Francisco, where they're teaching mindfulness practices to pregnant women, helping them get through the pregnancy, labor, and then early childhood parenting. And this is also showing very promising results in the early research. And then one area that I've been working on here is mindfulness-based stress reduction for teens. So Jon Kabat-Zinn's mindfulness-based stress reduction program is really meant for adults. And Gina Beagle in California developed a program called MBSRT, which has been modified in a couple of different variations, and the T stands for teens. And so this is an 8-week course, which traditionally would be done in a group setting, 5 to 15 youth or so, and currently I'm doing it in an individual setting at the youth health clinic, where we're going through different mindfulness practices in a very systematic way. We're training the young people as well as their families and also giving them homework so that way they practice it and integrate these practices into their home. So that's one area that we're going in. And here at Children's, I'm seeing a lot of teenagers with chronic illness, chronic pain, and chronic stress, and really meeting them where all of those issues are overlapping.
So I'm just going to say a few words about mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. This, as I said, was developed by Williams and Siegel, and Wendell Siegel's works at Toronto, so he's kind of a local guy. Basically, they wanted to look at how to prevent depressive relapse. So once a person's been depressed, how can you keep them out of depression? So they developed a program called mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which differs from straight-ahead cognitive therapy in that they're not actually trying to change thoughts and working with thoughts like cognitive therapists. It is more coming to a place of accepting what the thoughts are and then working from there. So, and then they also utilize cognitive therapy as a portion of it because cognitive therapy is shown to be very powerful for depression as well. We were able to meet Randy Stemple, who's just come out with a book called Mindfulness-Based Cognitive Therapy for Anxious Children. So she's used MBCT for anxiety in children 12 and under. And it's a beautiful book. She's done a lot of research on it. It's a 12-session program, and it has lots of wonderful handouts at the back that anybody could use for at any time. So I'll make sure that Sanan gets the reference here, and she can send it out to anybody who would like that. I also want to mention the work of Jim Garland, who's one of our mindfulness, probably sort of the person who's been practicing mindfulness-based work at Children's Hospital the longest, and she currently has the same program going, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for anxious teens. So she's got that currently going upstairs, and she's going to be running that again on a continuing basis. And maybe this sort of segues into what Jim and I are sort of planning, so maybe we should go first and then I'll...
So I've been at Children's Hospital for about 1 year, and one of the things I've learned and heard from many of my colleagues is that a lot of the teenagers who are being seen at Children's Hospital are really struggling with overwhelming stress, anxiety, especially in the area that I work in, a lot of teenagers with chronic pain and chronic illness, so kids with diabetes, lupus, inflammatory bowel disease, and many of them have been getting referred to my clinic because they're struggling with coping, or it's affecting their functioning, it's affecting their lives, it's affecting their families. So I've been offering the individual MBSR course, and when I met Jake, we had an interesting conversation about starting a group MBSR for teens course for adolescents with chronic illness at our hospital to help adolescents cope with the stress and manage their chronic illness. And then Jake also takes care of a lot of adolescents with primarily mood disorders, and it's actually very much of an overlapping population because many of the adolescents who are affected with chronic illness also have mood symptoms. So the distinction is somewhat arbitrary, but they are slightly different as well.
So Zinn and I have two sort of proposals in the works. One is to work with this population of chronic pain and depression, and the other one is to work with more depression by itself. And so we're going to be probably running two separate groups starting in the fall sometime, and we have proposals for grants for that out. And so the group that I'll be working with will be sort of more leaning towards the NBCT model because it's more directly related to suppression. So we'll keep you up to speed because we're going to be recruiting pretty soon.
I think we'll end with a description of some of the other mindfulness practices that we teach in these types of clinical interventions, and then Jake will lead us through one of those practices. So I mentioned earlier there's a distinction between formal and informal practices. Formal practices are the type of mindfulness practices that we need to set aside time for, and often we encourage our young people and adults to actually schedule those into their day. So examples of those are like the sitting and breathing practice that we started with, and that can take anywhere from 3 minutes to 30 minutes, or some people 60 minutes. Another one is called body scanning, in which we're mindful of different parts of our body. And this is really helpful for people who are struggling with their body, with chronic pain, or with many other carry tension in our body. One of the themes of mindfulness is actually that the mind and the body are not dichotomous. They're not two separate things, but actually the mind and the body interact with each other in really important and profound ways. So the body scan helps bring some mindfulness to our body. And then some informal practices that we can incorporate into our day means that we just bring our full awareness to the present moment in whatever activity that we're doing. And we can use our breath and follow our breath and then just be aware of the sensations, the thoughts and feelings that are occurring in that activity. So examples of that are mindful walking, mindful eating, mindfulness of daily activities, so even like washing the dishes, and then mindful communication. When we're communicating with a friend, a family member, a colleague, we can really be aware of what we're saying, what the other person is saying, what's arriving within us and between us in that moment.
So we'd like to end with what's called 3-minute breathing space, which is a mini meditation. It's a formal mindfulness practice, and it's one of the most important parts of the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy that most people report has been most helpful. And it's been used with adults, and it's actually one of the books sort of main one for children as well. So I want you to imagine, start with an hourglass. So it starts kind of wide, and the top wide part is what's happening right now? What's happening in the way your body's feeling? What emotions are you experiencing? What are your thoughts? Without trying to change them, without judging them, just awareness of what's present. And after that awareness has been achieved, the focus of awareness goes very, very narrow to what's called the breathing space. And at this point, you'll be asked to just focus on either your abdomen or your belly button or your nostrils, and just follow your breath and the sensations that occur at that point. It's just a single point of focus. And we'll take you through maybe 5 or 10 breaths. And then it expands again to the bottom of the hourglass, where it's becoming aware again of what's happening in your body, and that will end it. So if everybody would mind just being quietly, and if you're comfortable, closing your eyes. If not, you can just breathe in slightly as well. And becoming aware of the present moment, sitting wherever you are. And bringing awareness now to what you are experiencing in your body. Noticing anything that's present. Pressures, discomfort, itchiness, temperature. Awareness of whatever is present in your body. And now intentionally shifting awareness to what feelings are present. What emotions are present right now. Again, without judging them, without trying to change them. And shifting awareness again to what thoughts are present. What am I thinking right now? Perhaps you're not thinking, and that's a thought. And now gathering your attention and coming into a focused point. Choosing that point of focus of breath, either at your belly button or your nostrils. Noticing the in-breath and the out-breath. As best you can, staying with that single point of focus. Noticing sensations. As the breath moves in and out. Noticing when your attention wanders elsewhere. Seeing where it's going. intentionally bring it back to the breath. With your next in-breath, breathing in. And as you breathe out, expanding your awareness again, becoming aware of your body sitting in this chair, in this moment. Being aware of whatever is present in your body. Noticing it. Without trying to change it. And with your next breath, breathing into that space where your body is, and as you breathe out, opening your eyes.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Jake, and for that timer on mindfulness and also those very helpful exercises to help us put what we learn into practice. So at this time, I want to invite Nikki to share her experience with mindfulness.
Great. So I'd like to start with how mindfulness has affected me in my life and the changes that have occurred since my practice with Dr. Bo. So as my dad would say, I'm now able to clap for the small victories. So if I wake up and I have less pain than I did the day before, that's a small victory, and I can then draw strength from that to go through the rest of my day. And I'm also able to forgive myself now. So before, when I made a mistake, it was a huge deal, and it was a catastrophe, and I needed to be punished for it. But now I realize that I'm human. I have a quota for making mistakes, and I deserve the same quota as everyone else. And I'm also able to move on from bad experiences in my life and realize that by carrying that suffering with me, it makes the current moment more difficult. And it's also taught me patience. So, I mean, when training my dog last year, it was really frustrating and he was really difficult. But I realized that, you know, he has a quota for mistakes as well. And to be patient is to be fair to him. So in my practice, I'm able to pay more attention to my surroundings. I'm able to notice the way my parents are feeling, really listen to them, and really be present in the moment with them and care for them. And I've also learned not to fix things that aren't broken, such as my dog won't play fetch, but that's the way it is, and I have to deal with it. He has more fun running around the backyard with his ball than bringing it back to me, and that's fine. So I also realize that any practice will help. Any way that I'm able to pay attention to the moment more changes the way I view that moment. So specifically with my pain, I saw it as the source of all my problems in the beginning, that it was this horrible monster that I had to drag around with me all the time, and it made everything bad and ruined everything that I did. But now I'm able to see it as necessary. It's telling me that there's something wrong in my body, and unfortunately there's always something wrong in my body, but that's the way it is, and that's the way it probably always will be, and it is necessary. And because of that, I'm able to limit myself physically when I need to. So if there's a certain day that I can't go to the movies with my friends, that's the way it is. But that's just taking care of myself and making sure that I don't make it worse. So in mindfulness, things aren't always easy. And some difficulties that I encountered with my practice were making time for myself. Because before I thought any time for myself as wasted time. I wasn't being productive. I wasn't caring for someone else. But as Dr. Bo pointed out to me, you can't care for someone else unless you first care for yourself. And if you burn yourself out, you're no good to yourself and you're no good to anyone else. So for youth interested in mindfulness, I definitely recommend keeping an open mind about it. If you go in with an open mind, you're so open to every experience that comes with it. And realize that the change that you experience will be significant but not dramatic. It will be little things that change, so you'll notice things more. You'll be more patient with other people. You won't be a completely different person, but you'll be able to be more in the moment. And also ask for support from people around you. Really call in your support system because it's much easier to go through this with the help of other people. And for providers interested in it, really provide a non-judgmental ear to your students. People, I mean, for me, I really wanted someone to listen to me. I had a lot of doctors who had talked at me and not listen to me. And what Dr. Bo provided was a non-judgmental ear that I could tell anything to. But also be a realist about it. So really play up your student's curiosity and look at it as an experiment and a journey that you're taking together. And also make sure to mention that mindfulness transcends religion. That really it's taking care of yourself. And mindfulness has no hidden agenda behind it. It's all about taking care of yourself.
Okay. Sorry for the So I think what I'll do now is I will unmute the phone and I will do my best to moderate for the Q&A portion of the afternoon. And I think what makes sense to do is perhaps take a question in-house and then take one over the phone. So if you're over the phone and you have a question, feel free to speak up. If not, keep your phone on mute by pressing star 6. Thank you. So we'll begin. So do you have a question for the audience? Please help me show over the phone and put your hand up if you're in house. That would work well.
That's a really good question because, you know, for those of us who start thinking about using mindfulness, we just think it's fantasy, it's good for everything. And that may ultimately prove to be true, but I think there's a lot of caution to use in psychotic illness, for instance, where you can get lost in your mind. And there were concerns about bipolar disorder, but it's actually now being used very effectively for self-regulation in bipolar disorders once stabilized. So I think we still have to be aware of, you know, there may be a recommendation of contraindication.
I would add one thing to that is that Dr. Kabat-Zinn and some of the people who founded mindfulness based stress reduction feel very strongly that in order to this in a clinical setting, it's important for the teacher to have their own mindfulness practice and to be teaching from their own practice. And I think that's important, especially in the cases where you bring up, where you're worried about causing harm. I think that if a teacher hasn't gone through some of their own practices and struggled with some of the challenges that come up, they're going to have a much harder time guiding the students or the patients through those challenges.
For sure. Thank you. Did you have another question over the telephone? You can speak up if you have one. Okay, we'll take one in half.
What are the basic distinctions between mindfulness is for children, youth, and adults? As you were talking, I was just thinking, not so much different than adult-focused therapy.
That's a great question, and that's something that those of us who are working with children are learning as we go. Some of the major distinctions are the attention span of children and youth. So with the adult practices, a sitting meditation will often last 30 minutes, whereas with children and youth, they may be 5 or 10 or 15 minutes. So that's one major difference is the length of the practices. Another difference is that children and youth tend to be more active with their bodies and more aware of their bodies, so there'll be a little bit more emphasis on practices that involve the body and involve the senses, engaging the senses, rather than sitting quietly. And then the language will be a little bit different too, use a little bit more concrete language. So those are a few of the differences.
Yeah, we really like this book, her, the sample book, because she actually wrote a lot of those things that are different with children and adults. But you're right, I think the concept is still the same. And there are some things that children, you know, and adolescents need, which is more sugary body stuff. And one of the things, they often tend to be a little bit more shy. And so what Jane Garland has done recently is, you know, in groups, she'll get people to turn their chairs around so they're not looking at each other. At least they're sort of get used to how things are going. So, I mean, that could be also as well. So I think this is sort of a process that's unfolding. What are the, you know, developmental modifications that we need to make? And we'll be talking to you more about that.
Thanks for keeping it brief. So did you have another question? Feel free to speak up.
Hello. I was just wondering, being on the phone here, would it be possible for any of the books and programs to be put on the website somewhere? I couldn't quite catch all the names of everything over the phone. I'm just wondering if...
Yeah, definitely. I think what I'll do after the session is talk to everyone who was here and pull a list of resources and put that onto our website. So if you check back there in about a week's time in the events section and you click on the mindfulness event, I'll hopefully have the recording along with all the comprehensive list of resources on there.
So. Oh, that's excellent. Thank you.
No problem. Go ahead.
I have one other question. I'm just kind of curious if any of the people on the panel or if anyone is aware of any
good mindfulness sessions or groups that are going on in also perhaps in a less clinical setting, other than, for example, the Buddhist groups or whatever are doing, if there are any secular groups doing this either with or without children.
So the best resource I know for, are you speaking for adults or for children right now?
I would be curious for either, just if there were any groups going on in Vancouver for either.
So what I'm aware of is called NBSRBC. I think it's I'll provide the website for the listener, but I think it's NBSRBC.com or CA.
Okay.
And that gives kind of a listing and directory of the NBSR Buddhist World as well. Children, there's really not much right now. In fact, this is the beginning of it, and that's why we're really excited to present this in terms of kind of secular clinical offerings.
Yeah.
Right.
I think Ting, was it? Are you here? Yeah. Do you want to just talk about the one that you were telling me about today?
Yeah, I did a kind of one with also the Aboriginal Wellness Program at the VCH. It's the evening on a Monday, so I can also list that resources up. It's open for health people. It's a meditation group for
And it's just open, yeah.
I think Simon Fraser might be offering a group there. I know they have resources online, and many of the schools in Vancouver are also offering it.
Right. Thank you.
I hope that answers your question. So, do we have another question from our in-house audience?
Well, I was just gonna respond to what the other person asked. I'm in Victoria, listening to this on the phone in Victoria.
Okay.
And there is a Thich Nhat Hanh group here in Victoria, up near the Royal Jubilee Hospital.
Oh, okay.
And it meets weekly.
For those of you who are not familiar with that name, Thich Nhat Hanh, he is teaching mindfulness from a Buddhist context, and that speaks to some people, and it may not speak to everyone, but Thich Nhat Hanh is one of the major teachers of mindfulness from Buddhism in the West.
Right.
I have a quick question. I'm just wondering how mainstream practices like yoga would compare to the mindfulness practice that we're talking about here.
So yoga is actually considered by some people to be a form of mindfulness meditation. Mm-hmm. It's a movement meditation. So walking meditations can be considered a form of meditation. Qigong, yoga. So they definitely tie very strongly into awareness of body.
In the NBSR courses, yoga is a part of that. At the beginning of each course, there's a little bit, and we often call it mindful stretching. Maybe we won't use the word yoga, but it's about bringing our awareness to our breath and our body and the emotions.
Thank you. Do you have another question?
I have some questions regarding the MBSR course for teens, which is starting in the fall. I'm wondering if you could clarify any details on that.
It's a work in progress.
We're
in stages right now, so we don't have an official launch date yet.
But it probably will be for teens with significant anxiety, depression, or pain. We may not open that group up to teens who are very well. There's probably some lack of wellness program.
For issues such as chronic fatigue, would that be considered?
Absolutely.
Okay. And I would check the website if I'm wanting to register my daughter for that. Is that correct? In the near future, you'll have some details about that, and there'll be some kind of registration process for that.
I'm actually not sure about how to register for the session.
Well, I because it's a work in progress, we will let Saman know what we're up to.
Right. Okay.
And then she can post it on the Kelsey website.
Great.
Thank you. It won't be in the near future.
Yeah. We'll put that up as it comes along.
Okay.
And you can email me directly as well if you were wanting to find out the exact date. So I can keep an eye on that and email you back.
Thank you.
Personally, though, if you're interested in the individual MBSR course for something like chronic fatigue, though, you can always
Okay, so we have another enough here. I have a question for the panel is how long you would expect to see results or from your own personal experience? What do you notice on your motivation? So much into it, and then we also acknowledge you is more active in the mode and how it can the whole mindfulness practice in a daily basis.
Okay, really what motivates me to continue is I find when I haven't been practicing as much, I'm definitely more irritable and a lot less patient, but the more I basically practice to maintain the calm state that I try to live in most of the time, and I find my resilience definitely goes down when I'm not practicing it, so I'm a lot better at dealing with sort of spontaneous challenges when I am practicing.
Thank you. Time for our next question. Anybody over the phone?
Hi.
Hi.
I'm just wondering if you have any experience around barriers to the concept of mindfulness, and I'm thinking about two or three clients I have who very, very much benefit from this, but based on their religious beliefs, they are not yet contemplating the idea of the usefulness of it. So do you have any comments around that?
That was actually a topic that was brought up at the international conference, and the speakers were very strong in their opinion that religious views should be removed as much as possible, just for the reasons that you probably are talking about. And yeah. So to me, for instance, making the language more common language rather than even something simple as yoga, which we've accepted into our language, you know, even that can be a bit disturbing to some people. So, you know, to change that to mindful stretching. And I think Nikki, you spoke so well to that. It really goes beyond. Anyway, so maybe you should go online and say that.
I think the important thing about mindfulness is not our beliefs. When we teach mindfulness, we're not asking you to believe anything or think in a certain way. It's a practice of being aware. So it is not about religion.
In that specialized population area, they are quite concrete. Okay? That's been a real difficulty for me.
Actually, if I can speak to that, there's a counseling center in Vancouver called the Burnaby Counseling Center. That's a Christian-based organization, and they use a lot of mindful-based counseling, and it would be helpful maybe to contact them and see how they introduce it to their patients.
Oh, thank you.
Very helpful, yeah. Thank you so much for that comment. Sure.
Yeah, one of the things you mentioned was that it was helpful to you to understand more of your parents. Relationships are jeopardized by really not having adequate understanding or the people that we're close to or really close to how to disclose. And I was wondering if you could maybe discuss a little bit and specifics of developing improved mindfulness for people in this situation, how older shared intimate relationships.
Yeah. Actually, one practice that we did work on was called mindful listening. And it's really being in the moment with someone, really paying attention to what they're saying and removing distractions. So, I mean, my parents and I were famous for the discussion over top of the laptops. And, I mean, we weren't really listening to each other. We were focused on the computer. So, I mean, we removed all distractions and really make lots of eye contact and really take the heart and take the person is saying and really speak from the heart. And I think through that, we were able to see each other's point and actually be less defensive. So we could talk about difficult issues, but by listening and really listening to the other person with as little judgment as possible, we were able to sort of remove the defensive barriers that we had set up and really feel for the other person and really feel their point of view.
Do we have another question?
Hi. I just wanted to say, is it Nikki?
Yeah.
I just wanted to say, you're so well-spoken, Nikki, and you described you know, what you're doing and how it's changed you, the call victories, I think is what you said.
Yeah.
That was very, very well done, and I just wanted to commend you on it because it explained it to me in a way. I'm a clinician, and it explained it to me in a way that was really helpful.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Sure.
I'm just wondering, how do you deal with the challenge of less willing participants? For example, you know, a fairly self-centered, closed-minded kid that would really benefit from it, but getting them over that hump. Sort of describing my son here.
Yeah, really tough. I mean, probably all sorts of strategies. One of the ones that I commonly use is an experiment. You know, give this a try if you're really not, you know, at all interested, and you're welcome to drop it. The other one, you know, is the age-old, let's make a deal, you know. I mean,
that's great.
I would also say that there's many different ways of introducing. You don't even have to use the word mindfulness with a big M, and you don't have to make it an 8-week session or even a 2-week thing. It can be a 3-minute thing or a 3-breath thing. So mindfulness is actually extremely flexible, and sometimes just presenting it as, okay, let's just take 3 breaths and let's just be aware of that. And then doing that again and again, that may help introduce someone.
There's another process called motivational interviewing, which is just the basic approach of asking questions, you know, the sort of Socratic method. What is it that, you know, makes you hesitate from even considering this? I mean, very many questions, and sometimes that is actually helpful anyway because you get them to say.
Well, thank you.
Good luck with that.
Yeah. Thanks. I'll be bringing him to you guys.
Offered his services.
Thanks. I think we have probably time for one or two more questions. So if there's any more,
if you could comment on mindfulness practices.
That's a great question, and there is a lot of work using mindfulness with trauma, especially with DBT, as I'm sure you're familiar with. But that's really helpful. Two things. One is that a lot of people carry trauma in their bodies, and so mindfulness can really help get to know that. And the other thing is mindfulness really helps us deal with the trauma in the present moment, because there's a kind of conception of trauma is not an event that happened in the past, but it's rather a state of the nervous system and the mind and the body that's occurring in the present. And so mindfulness can really help us to bring our awareness to the present that's happening in the present moment, rather than being constantly pulled back into the past, or on the other hand, denying and being blind to the past or trying to cut it off. There's a lot of work with
mindfulness. Yeah, and I think this also speaks a little bit to when the question is, you know, are there times when you've got to be really careful, you don't know, you could. So I would put that in that category. And I think DBT is a really excellent model because they use very short mindfulness, sort of, that would be much better than having to sit for 15 or 30 or 45 minutes. I think that would be really asking for trouble.
Time for one more, if there's another question.
Sensory motor training is really a mindfulness training, because you're really putting your focus on that area.
So I want to take a moment and thank our speakers for bringing their knowledge and expertise, and thank you, Spencer, for bringing your insight on mindfulness to our panel. Very much appreciated. We're so lucky to have you with us.